Early on, we introduced Brother Irwin Kolinsky. Many of you brethren have never seen Brother Irwin, so we had to speak a little about him. Well, now our privilege is to introduce to you again Brother Paul Malley. Now, we've all seen Brother Paul, and we've all heard Brother Paul. And like all the speakers at conventions and wherever, we are richly and blessed by the efforts that the elders put into their discourses. So we'll turn the study over to Brother Paul and wait for the blessing that he has for us.
Did you announce the title?
Oh, the title, The Patience of God, or What's Holding Up the Operation of the Kingdom.
Thank you, Brother Paul and Brother Robert, for that prayer. The patience of God. We're always talking about our patience and our impatience and how we have to bear and how we don't bear. Have we thought about the patience of God? You know, faith without a future is like a ship without a course. If faith means anything, it means the future. If you claim to have a faith, you're saying, I have a future. That's what you're saying. A faith that is based on the past goes nowhere. A faith that looks only to the past is a faith that belongs in history. A faith that holds only to history is a faith that produces a historian. But a faith that looks to the future is a faith that's alive. A faith that expects a future is a faith that has power in the component of hope. You know, we talk about hope, but you know there's a power to hope. Some people have the low-level power to hope, and some people have a high-level power to hope. It's all a matter of the intensity of your expectations. If you don't have expectations, you have a low-level power in hope. I'm not saying you don't have any hope, but very low. But if you have a high-level expectations, your hope is powerful. For you not only believe, but you're expecting it to happen. A faith that forecasts the future is a faith that's visionary. You know, Bible students don't really have a religion. I'm sure you all wrestle with this idea. You know, do we really have a religion? I don't think so. You know, like headquarters and a catechism and a denominational description and candles and beautiful robes. I mean, look at the elders. Bob, I didn't mean you, but that's okay. Look at the elders. They look like ordinary people. They don't have any beautiful robes on and white, you know, the white collars and things like that. We don't really have a religion in the same sense that religious people understand religion. Then what do we have? We have a vision. That's what we have. We have a vision of the future. A faith in this vision. Our vision of the future is the kingdom of God on earth. That's the bottom line, friends. We can sometimes get lost in all of the intricacies of the truth, and I don't mean to apologize for that, but sometimes we get lost in all of the beauties and the intricacies and forget the bottom line for what it's all about, why we're here. The vision of the kingdom of God on earth. That's the bottom line. It's been preached by the prophets from old. It's been preached 2,000 years ago. And we are the feet members waiting for that kingdom to happen. And we're asking the question, what's holding up the operation of the kingdom? And as we look around, we can't help see children in Africa. You know, with the skeleton bones, you see that on television? Blown up stomachs in Somalia, and in the Congo, and Ethiopia. Mothers looking out helpless. 3.25 billion people in the world are now starving or near starving. In the United States, the poverty level has increased to 34%. And we ask the Lord, Lord, the people of the world need the kingdom. And our impulse is, why can't we start it right now? Are there accomplishments that must be completed first? And then we look at Bosnia, genocide by the Serbs with innocent women and children. It's a religious war between the Islams and the Christians. But let's not forget it. Islam is on a war path. Allah is not our God. We had an interesting, at the university, you know, the university plays the ecumenical position. You know, they invite the rabbis and the ministers and the Muslims in to show that we're cosmopolitan. And the priest was invited this time. He started his prayer by saying, we're praying to Allah, and we're praying to Jehovah God, and we're praying as if they were all one. Allah is a war God, a warlike God. That God believes in killing. But the world needs peace, desperately. And then we see the destruction of the environment. The ozone hole, if you haven't heard about it, there's a hole up there in the atmosphere. It's getting bigger. The atmosphere is being polluted. Water is contaminated. 40% of the world's drinking water, let me repeat that, 40% of the world's drinking water is unsafe to drink. 35,000 chemicals are being dumped annually into the air, into the streams, into the lakes, into the oceans. We're concerned, for it appears that God's creation is going down the drain. And we turn to the Lord and we ask, Lord, we must stop this pollution. We must stop it before it's too late, or your creation will be destroyed. And you know, the silence of God can be bewildering to people who believe in Him. The silence of God can be even confusing to those who want immediate answers. And the silence of God can be perplexing to those who do not understand. The silence of God is mistaken for the patience of God. That's what we're experiencing when we don't get these immediate answers. The Lord is patient. And there are reasons why the kingdom has not arrived in its operating state. God is being patient now more than ever before. And you know, there's been many scriptures that have pointed out this patience of God. Let me just cite a few. Numbers 14:7. Remember at Kadesh Barnea? Israel sinned so grievously that God was ready to destroy everyone. Now, picture that. For God to do that, they must have done pretty badly. God said, I will smite them with pestilence, and I will disinherit them. Moses interceded and pleaded with God. What a man, what a character. He pleaded with God not to destroy them. And he even said, Lord, the Lord is long-suffering. God held back. He patiently endured. And then remember the great flood. Remember, at first, God was going to destroy everyone, all of mankind, Genesis 6, 5 to 7. But he did not act immediately. Why? Because he wanted anyone who was righteous to be saved. And as a result, Noah and his family was saved. He held back, but he was patient for many, many years. And then the judgment when Satan rebelled. Justice would have demanded Satan's execution right on the spot. But God held back, for he saw a great experience and a lesson for all his creatures, both human and spiritual. The wicked have misunderstood and misinterpreted his patience. In fact, I could just picture Satan going around, at least in my mind, telling all the others, look, I've gotten away from it. God hasn't done anything to me. I've rebelled and I've disobeyed. I've gotten away with it. Maybe that's how he kind of convinced some of his cohorts. He may have said that. But God has been patient over a long period of time with what an awesome quality. And we can go on with other scriptures, but what an awesome quality that God has. The Apostle Paul in Romans 15, 4 to 5, identifies God as the God of patience, suggesting many exhibit patience, but many have failed with their patience. But God is God because of his patience. But we might inquire, what are the events that still need completion, that is demanding more and more of the patience of God? And brethren, we're going to make some suggestions to you this afternoon. Now, we can't cover them all because time is limited, but we will make some suggestions. And the first suggestion that we make is that the completion of the church class has not been filled. The 144,000 is not complete. This is by far the most important single reason for the patience of God. We see signs that this class is being filled. We see signs. I mean, I'll give you an example of the number of immersions that we see every year. Do you experience the number of immersions that we've had 30 years ago, 40 years ago? Remember those times how, you know, there was a lot of activity and a lot of immersion? Are we getting them today? I don't see it. I kind of made a little tabulation around the world, so to speak. And Wilmington, I'm not sure they had one this year, was it? Two. But I can remember in Wilmington, we always used to have like a dozen or more or something. And then in the east and the west coast, the Sylmar, I think there were five this time, but last year they had none. And we go to Germany, France only had one in 2 years. Poland. Now, you might say there's a lot of immersions going on in Poland. Because there's about, they have, when they have a general convention, there's about 2,000, 3,000 that show up, which is a pretty hefty group. And when they have that kind of, there's usually about 200 that immerse. I understand last year there was 15. Now, what is that saying to us? Is there a message there? Now, some of you might say, well, we're not witnessing enough. That might be it, too. We're not going out providing the witness work, perhaps. But I'd like to think that we're really living in the very last period of time. I think the church class is filling up. And we are the ones that the Lord is patient with and waiting for. But we might ask, well, what is it about us that's holding it up? I'm ready. Are you ready? If I had to ask how many of you are ready, you know, how many of you, if the Lord called on the telephone to Brother Paul Balco, our chairman, and he got that telephone call and the Lord is on the phone and he says, I'm taking everybody now at this moment. How many of you would say, no, I'm not ready to go? You know, I'll never forget a sister in Jerusalem. And I kind of said facetiously to her, I said, you know, the Lord may take us at this point here in Jerusalem. I says, this may be it, you see. She says, oh, no, I got to go home and close up my house. What is it about us? I'd like to make this suggestion. The answer is in this crystallization of character. This is in Revelation 21, 9 to 11, where the Lamb's wife, the New Jerusalem, has a character glory like crystals. Now, you know what a crystalline structure is. Clear, brilliant, multifaceted, sparkling, with all kinds of fixed geometries. Now, there are two dimensions to crystalline characters. The first dimension is the development of the character itself, the Christ-like character, and the second is the fixation of that character no matter what the experience is. Now, my observation is I think we do a good job in developing that Christ-like character because it's clear what the model is. But I think where we fall down is the character falls down when we have a trial. Or when we have a conflict, or when we have a difficulty. And you see this in the business meetings, by the way. You never see it in the conventions. I mean, you know, conventions are so wonderful. But in the business meetings is where you see that character falling apart. And the Lord has indicated that you might not only develop the Christ-like character, but it must be fixed in that character likeness no matter what the fire is. God will not give you a divine body if the character fluctuates up and down and in and out and right and left. It must be a Christ-like character in all respects for all time. In fact, I would say in all eternity. Can you conceive of getting a divine body and in 1 million years from today it goes back to the human? I think this is where the problem is. And so, these two dimensions. So now watch this now. He calls people, and then he allows them to develop. He sanctifies in that development, and then he tests, and then he evaluates. If that individual is rejected, he has to call somebody else to replace them. And I see, in my view, all those that are being immersed are replacements of those who did not make the standard. They are all replacements. See? So, he's so merciful and so patient to give that individual all the time they need to make it. But if they don't, then what does he have to do? Call again and develop again and retest again. And if it doesn't make it, has to call again and redevelop and retest, call, retest, develop. That process is consumed time. It's no wonder it's taken 2,000 years to develop those jewels. You know, in this connection, if any of you has entertained the idea, I want to help God now for the operation of the kingdom, the start of the kingdom for the world. I want to help God right now. What can I do? There's only one thing you can do. Only one. All the others contribute. All the others help. All the others support. But the one thing you can do right now is make your call and election sure. You've been called. You have been developed. You've been sanctified. Go all the way and make it complete. For the more we do that, the quicker the kingdom will operate. I can't think of anything else that you could do to help God in this process. Okay, let's look at another area. And again, we're talking about what demands God's patience. This is in connection with the regathering of the Jews. Isaiah 43:5-6 states categorically that God wants to regather the Jews. This is a plan. This is a program. This is not a wishy-washy, incidental thing. It's part of his program to bring the Jews back to Israel. Luke 21:24 indicates that the time to favor Israel has come. And what's holding up the regathering? There's an Arab world against Israel. The Arabs fiercely want to destroy Israel. The Arabs still have an economic boycott over Israel. That's 22 Arab countries that are in an economic war with Israel. And there's an anti-Semitic world against Israel. Anti-Semitics are in the billions. Anti-Semitics are in Russia and Germany, England, Spain, Italy, France, and the United States. And there's a Muslim world against Israel. 1.1 billion Muslims against 5 million. The Islamics want to control the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem. They want a Muslim flag over the dome in a very holy site that they regard as a very holy site. And the peace process that you have just seen signed is a game. That's not going to hold. It's obvious that Arafat is out to get Jerusalem. Arafat has threatened a holy war to liberate Jerusalem. Rabin has even warned him not to talk like that. In fact, they're about ready to shut down the PLL offices in Jerusalem. And there's been a war of words and escalating between Israel and the PLO over the future status of Jerusalem. It's a most sensitive issue between Arabs and Israel. Now, the statement came out when Arafat was given the talk in South Africa, I think it was, when he called for the jihad, you know, the holy war to free Jerusalem from the Israeli rule. And now the struggle will come for Jerusalem. You know, this Arafat speaks with a two-forked tongue. You know what a two-forked tongue is. One tongue speaks one way and the other tongue speaks the other way. You know, I believe the Lord gave us two ears to hear better, right? And two eyes to hear better, but one tongue, meaning you talk only one way. But I think Arafat has a two-forked tongue. The one tongue he's talking is peace, and the other tongue he's talking war. Well, this is causing some rather unique concern by Rabin. Rabin really wants peace, and he's ready to give land for it, which I think is a mistake, in my view. I think it's a mistake also from the Lord's standpoint. Because the Lord says, it's time for you to take the land I've given you. But Rabin is so desperate, he is now asking the Pope for help. I've got an article right here with a picture. The evidence. Rabin goes to Vatican City and asks for help to win the peace in the Middle East. It's at a time of crisis when there are so many forces against the peace process. Rabin has asked the Pope to use his influence on hundreds of millions of his followers, the Catholics, to support the peace process and to influence the elements, the Arab elements, to return and to be sincere about peace. So, We are moving so fast, friends, we have to watch this or we're going to miss it for the final progression. The theme of peace now is coming out so fast that Bible students are asking, is this the peace that we read about in 2 Thessalonians 5:3? Remember the peace that says, when they shall say peace and safety, then sudden destruction shall fall upon them? And also in Ezekiel 38:39, in which Israel will be in unwalled villages. Is this the same peace of that? I don't think so. I don't believe this peace will hold. But there's been a lot of changes. And we already said that the battle for Jerusalem is starting. I'd say within 2 years, maybe even within one year, you're going to find Jerusalem pretty much like the Gaza Strip. Aggressive uprisings by a lot of groups. If I don't mistake it, in my view of things, you will see it within a year, but no more than 2 years. There'll be aggressive uprisings by the Arabs and by the settlers and so forth. And Rabin will really have his hands filled. But why are these changes occurring? Well, first of all, the PLO is bankrupt. This is where he's playing the game. The PLO is bankrupt. They have no money. They were given $6 million by the Saudis, if you remember, before the Gulf War. But since they changed sides, the Saudis have cut it off. But they have found a new source of money, the United States. Because apparently Israel is giving land for peace, and the United States has given billions to have peace in both groups. Talk about negotiations. So, the United States is pressured, and I think their $3 billion has been allocated in a budget for both the PLO and for Israel. Second, the Shiites, fundamentalists, want to dump Arafat. Arafat is hurrying to stay on top. He's been trying for 25 years to set up a Palestinian state, and the fundamentalists are saying that Arafat has failed. And Arafat has said, I don't want to be a Gorbachev. There's a third reason. The Soviet support is no longer around, and the United States has emerged as the sole superpower. And everybody now is looking to the United States to support them financially. Now, these are just evidences that events are coming close, are building up. It's kind of a time clock that's developing, a time clock that begins to start to tick. And I see a rather interesting development with three scenarios. Three of the probably the most significant scriptures that we have in terms of biblical prophecy. The smiting of the Jordan, the invasion of Gog into Israel, and I don't know what happened to my notes here. I'm looking for them. I just finished it about 3 o'clock this afternoon. The smiting of the Jordan by Elijah and Elisha, the Lord's great army of chapter 2 of Joel, and the invasion of Gog to Israel. Now, we're all familiar with these prophecies, and in fact, we have studied them. And if you remember, the Lord's great army is the aggressive uprisings by the general discontent that exists in society. We have the political discontents, we have the social discontents, we have the economic discontents, and we have the moral discontents. And then in the smiting of the Jordan, as we see it, when the cloak had smitten the Jordan, this way we believe that's the smiting or the separation of the membership, of religious membership from the religious authorities. That's the breakdown of religions. and then the invasion of Gog to Israel, which we call Jacob's trouble. All three of these are not disconnected. They're all connected. They might be looking at the same complexity, but with three different views, so to speak. And we see now signs that these three trends are beginning to emerge in a very significant way. So that Israel, which is heart and core of these trends, has now become a countdown, kind of a ticking time clock. In fact, I would say God's time clock. And you know what a ticking clock is? It's counting down as if some kind of spectacular is about to happen. So what we're saying is, watch Israel and you will see God's hand in the affairs of the world. Watch Israel and you will see God deliver his people and the world of mankind. Watch Israel and you'll see a great miracle of our time. Watch Israel and you'll see these three prophecies coming to fruition. And never let us be said that we haven't lived in the age of miracles. And brethren who went to Jerusalem last year were inspired by the trip for many reasons. Not only the convention, not only the biblical sites, not only the international brethren, but let me suggest an additional one. The brethren knew that they were in the land where God was moving, where the action is. The action is not in Disneyland. Yet they're going down there 100,000 a day. That's the admission count that they have. 100,000 a day. There's no action there. Or in China or in South America, and I don't want to minimize the work of the brethren in those areas. But where is God's action? It's in Israel. God is moving in Israel. And so these events, these three major prophetic events, are now coming to a focus, but not quite there yet. I wish we had the time where we can develop these three, but I think most of us are familiar with it to understand that each of them have elements by which, in which certain things have got to happen. So let's take another one that's demanding God's patience. If we look at the world, we see problems are emerging faster than solutions. They are like a crescendo. In music, you know what a crescendo is. And the problems are not just problems, but they're accelerating, growing. AIDS is out of control. Drugs still remains the number one condition to destroy the human mind. Organized crime is a sweeping rampage targeting women and children. Aggressive religious fundamentalism is threatening global peace, and there's no way to stop it. Ethnic cleansing, for example, is what we're speaking of. Pollution is affecting everyone. Deficit spending is worldwide. Not just the United States, but all the countries are experiencing this deficit spending. And it's like a catch-22. You solve one problem here, and two more pop up over here. And you solve the two more here, four more pop up over here. And we really ask, are there any world leaders? You know, is Clinton a world leader? You know, are we solving it? I was in the elevator in New York recently. I was doing some research there. And I was in the elevator and we met this lawyer who was attending a seminar. And we got into a conversation. I'm not sure how exactly we got on, but we began to talk. And I asked him, I says, you're here with a lot of lawyers? He says, oh, yes. Are you solving the problems of the world? He says, no. I says, well, you know, are the problems getting worse? He says, yes. What's happening? What are the two culprits? The two are suits, and malpractice. And, you know, it didn't take me long to look into that a little bit. And I began to make a list of some of the things that's going on. A woman was in the supermarket and she was buying vegetables and whatnot. And there was a little kernel of grapes on the floor. Just one kernel of grape. She stepped on and slipped and she fell down. She sued the supermarket for $10 million. Would you believe it? She got it. And there was another case where a mother was walking through a department store with her son. And as she was walking, a little piece of the ceiling fell down and hit him on the head. What did she do? She sued the department store. Okay? The department store turned around and sued the landlord, because that really is his responsibility. Okay? The landlord turned around and sued the architect. The architect says, all right, okay. He turned around and sued the general contractor. The general contractor turned around and sued the subcontractors. I think there are five levels of suits. How long do you think this will be settled? Will a couple years, 5 years, 10 years? I think at least 10 in going through the courts. You know, when we talk about anarchy, we're not talking about a war. Anarchy is the breakdown of society. Anarchy is where governments don't seem to be able to solve its problems. Anarchy is like a no way out. We are arriving at a point in human history, probably at no other point, where the no way out stage is emerging. The no way out stage is an anarchy stage. And the nations of the world are sensing no way out of our problems. The statesmen of the world are saying, we are in crisis. Something must be done. The governments of the world are wondering, have we tried all forms of government? And I think that's the Lord allows that for a very important reason. Trying all these forms of government, fascism and communism and socialism and totalitarianism and democracy. These are all isms. The Lord says, go ahead and try them all and see if they will work. We have arrived at a point where we tried them all. Democracy, I think, is the last one. I don't know, unless there's something else going to emerge. But is democracy working? I mean, I don't have the answers to these questions. You know, you must reflect on them. But the Lord, I think, is deliberately saying, go ahead and try them all so that we will then come in with Christ's government. And we'll show you how that works. And that will work, you see. No way out means all doors are closed and the world is splitting at the seams. Signs have emerged that we are experiencing the end of an old civilization. And that's the period that we call anarchy. You know, as we talk about these things, we can't help but bring out Jacob's trouble, a no-way-out experience. The alliance of Jacob's trouble seems to be getting clearer and clearer, in my view. I think we have those elements already on the scene. They haven't come together yet, but they're already on the scene. For example, Islam, in my view, is a way in which the alliance can be put together in Ezekiel 38, 1 through 6. Persia today is, and that's Iran, is Islamic. Kush, that's Ethiopia, is Islamic. Put, today, that's Libya. It's Islamic. Gomer, that could possibly be the Balkans, which is Bosnia and Macedonia. That's Islamic. Togomar, today, that's Turkey and Azerbaijani. It's Islamic. What we're waiting for now is Russia. We're waiting who could be the Gog. Well, there is an individual that has just emerged. His name is Zhirinovsky. Now, you know, I'm sure you've heard about him, and I'm sure you're collecting information about him, but I'll never forget what one journalist said about him. He is the Hitler of Hitlers. So if you can think of many kinds of Hitlers, he is the chief one. Could he be the one? I don't know, friends. But we have an individual that seems to fit the specifications of ruthlessness and a one who will proceed without any compulsion for what we would see in Ezekiel 38 and 39. The no way out concept can be seen with the inability of the United Nations to put out the fires. The United Nations is an association of 159 countries in the world. It has now taken on global issues. The United Nations is now the police force. That's the police department in the world. So that they want to behave as such. The United Nations mission and purpose is to create and maintain peace. They are peacemakers, but everywhere they attempt to solve peace, they are failing. In Ireland versus England, war continues. In Turkey versus the Kurds, war continues. Bosnia versus the Serb, war continues. Somali versus the UN, Somali is bleeding. Georgia versus Azerbaijani, Georgia is sinking. Haiti versus the United States. War may start out, we don't know, but the UN is in that no way out. Let's take another and last suggestion as to what is facing God that's demanding his patience. That's in population growth. Now, there's no question that the concentration of people in different parts of the world, especially in cities, has now raised the question of a sustainable future. Half of the population in the world now live in cities, and the other half in farms. But the march of present-day civilization is towards cities. The problem is not so much numbers of people as it is the distribution of people. Because if you stand in the middle of the Bronx in New York, or you stand in the middle of Tokyo, or you stand in the middle of Sao Paulo, Brazil, and you look out and you say, the world is overpopulated, if you stand in the middle of those cities. But if you go outside, you'll see a different picture. And the population continues. But the implication for food supply, pollution environment, concerns, and the sewer systems in the city. Would you believe it that these same cities that we spoke of, same cities, 50% of the world's population, 50% of those in the cities, of the cities, do not have sewer systems? Think about that. They do not have sewer systems. So how do they get rid of their sewage? Those of you who have been to Nigeria, that was one of the things I'll never forget. As you walk along the street, you see these troughs along the way, and there you'll see the sewage. So, you know, we see the population of the cities is a big problem. Incidentally, if you stand in the middle of Sao Paulo, Brazil, which I did recently. Now, Sao Paulo, Brazil is not a well-known city, but it's a big city in Brazil. If you stand in the middle of that, you get the feeling of overpopulation, but I saw a unique skyscraper. And somebody pointed out to me, that's a cemetery. A cemetery in the middle of the city, in the skyscraper. They're burying people on the 34th floor. Many have said, Lord, you must stop this population growth. Lord, the planet Earth is doomed. Lord, you must do something since you're the designer and you know the capacities and you know the limitations. Yet the Lord doesn't stop it. The population continues unabated. Have you wondered why God doesn't stop the population growth? Does God know something we don't know? Of course he does. And I'm going to make two suggestions. I think God is allowing population to grow because we live in a designed universe. He knows the numbers within each of the design levels. For example, in the spiritual world, the number of spirit beings in the universe are in the trillions. In the fleshly world, the number of animals and of fish and fowl is in the trillions. In the vegetable world, the number of trees and shrubs and plants and mosses are in the trillions. In the mineral world, the number of particles of gold and silver and iron and copper are in the trillions. In the economical world, the number of raindrops and snowflakes and leaves are in the trillions. If our designer and our creator uses trillions in every part of man's domain, why should we stop with the billions that we're talking about here? Neither am I suggesting there'll be trillions of people. I'm not suggesting that, but I'm saying, why do we stop at what we have? Does the designer know something we don't know? I think so. From God's point of view as a designer, he knows what the planned purpose is. He was the one that says the earth's diameter was to be 8,000 miles and its circumference was to be 25,000 miles. Why did he use those parameters? He could have made twice the size of the earth, three times the size. And he could have said, well, the capacity could be increased. Or he could have made it less, 4,000 miles in diameter or 2,000 miles. Why did he fix that 8,000 miles in diameter and the 25,000 miles in circumference if he did not have a figure in mind as to what would be the population for the earth? What we're saying, friends, is that God as a designer is patiently waiting for the population to grow to sufficient size to fit the future use. I don't know. This is speculation. I have no scriptures. But maybe the Lord is going to use the human family in the other parts of the planets. If you're impressed with 9 planets, don't be. Because they now have discovered 21 new planets in the universe, in the cosmos, with the new Hubble telescope, with the new satellites, and the telescopes and so forth, the radio telescopes, they have now identified at least 21 planets that have the same conditions that the Earth has out there in the universe. It's amazing how Bible students reject the idea when scientists are planning on it. Now, there are other events that the patience of God, time limits us to any of them, but briefly, Babylon must fall. Revelation 18:2. Babylon has diminished, but then again we see some power coming back. They're negotiating with Israel for diplomatic exchange. Rabin runs to them for advice that just enhances their power. But we're looking for Babylon to fall apart and receive its retribution. And we see all kinds of things happening, the emerging of homosexual practices of the priests. Maybe that's the spark to cause a domino fall. And also, we see a movement going on. I've seen a report where Pat Robinson, who's the evangelical leader, he has said this: I'm convinced on the political scene that if the evangelical churches, the Roman Catholic churches, and the Orthodox Jews, those three groups, I'll repeat them, if the evangelical churches and the Roman Catholic churches and the Orthodox Jews, if all of us work together, we can elect anybody to office at any level, school boards, state legislation, city councils, mayors, governors, House of Representatives, senators, and president, if they all got together. I kind of wonder if they will get together. If they get together, then we could see the scenario of the aggressive uprisings of people and the Lord's great army, because we know these organizations have got to be toppled. And we could see perhaps the Lord's great army coming up and working against this effort. And I'm sound saying this is it, but I'm saying, friends, we got to watch it. You see. Incidentally, when he said that, he had the concurrence of Cardinal John O'Connor. And they came up with a 25-page manifesto called The Evangelicals and Catholics Together. He does not say in this report whether they had any rabbi agreement. But Babylon must fall. That's another area that must be must transpire. And then I believe that another possible war is going to occur. Now, I may get some disagreement here, but nonetheless, I've got the podium. When you're on the podium, you can say what you want. There's going to be another war in Israel. I'm talking before Jacob's trouble. I use the text Zechariah 11:14, for we see that land is being given away. I don't think that's according to God's program. And we might even find some civil unrest because the settlers are not accepting many of the things that's going on between Israel, the Israeli government, and the United States government. So therefore, this event must happen. And then we wait for the time when Israel is to be a victor over all the nations. And so what we're saying is, Israel, let's face it, Israel is going for another war. And the scenario which is to be watched very careful is the battle over Jerusalem. Now, I believe when that uprising occurs, there will be a representative for the United Nations into the West Bank. And remember in Joel, the third chapter, verse 2, I will gather all the nations into the valley of Jehoshaphat. How can you gather 159 nations into the Kidron Valley? Because that's what the valley of Jehoshaphat is. How are you going to get 159 nations there? You can't. What did the Lord mean? Is it possible that one United Nation representative in the Kidron Valley is the gathering of all the nations of the world? I would suggest to you it might be. And why is the United Nations in the West Bank, right next to the Dome of the Rock in the Kidron Valley? Because there is aggressive uprising within a very short period of time. Let me pull together what we've been saying. We have a patient God who is both long-suffering as well as merciful. As we look at these contemporary issues, we have to admit that God has been patient with us for reaching our crystallized characters. We know we're not all fully crystallized. And that's a lesson we want to take with us. Complete your calling and make it sure. That's the one effort you must make in your life, and you must make it as quickly as you can and as effectively as you can. The Lord is being patient with you and with me. Second, we have to admit that God has been patient with Israel and its regathering. He wants the regathering to occur. It's part of the plan. It's not happening. And George Bush, in my view, George Bush is out as president because he stopped the settlers. Now some of you say, well, what are the facts? Do you know that George Bush, right after the Gulf War, was the most popular president in the history of the United States? His popularity poll went up to something like 95 and 96. The highest popularity that any president at any time had. How was it in 1 year he was voted out? And I would suggest to you what he did, he stopped the immigration, not fully, but he stopped that tremendous immigration that was going in, that tremendous regathering. We have to admit that God is bearing with world conditions. We know they have not arrived at the no way out point, but they are arriving. They're quickly arriving at that point. We have to admit that God has been bearing with population, reaching a population figure, but not reaching capacity. And the abortion is working against this plan. We have to admit Babylon, even though weakened, still stands. It must receive its retribution. We know the patience of God, the long-suffering of God, that God wills that all who are called be given a merciful chance to make their call and election sure. But we're reminded that God is doing the impossible. He's doing with mankind the incredible. He's doing with you a huge miracle. And if you want to find what this goal has been, it's in Genesis 1:26. Remember when he said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness." That's his goal. It's taken 7,000 years to do it. And I see all of these things as seeds. Seeds of a future eternity. Adam and Eve were seeds. 30 billion have resulted. The Garden of Eden was only a seed. The world has been created. But the world is also going to be extended to other planets. Jesus and the church are only seeds. That's all they are. For the future creative work that they have throughout the universe. Looking at it from this standpoint, then at the great benefit of God's patience. What a great God we have to be patient while these seeds are being developed. And I would say that no great work is done in a hurry. It took almost two failures on God's part. I hate to speak of God failing, because God never fails. But it took almost two failures. The first one was at the flood. I mean, just think, if he wiped out them all and says, "I made a mistake." But he didn't. And then the other at Armageddon. It took forgiveness and miracles and charity and sacrifices, including the Logos. It took the death of every human being as a personal experience. It took the tolerance of evil and corruption and sin and pain for humans at its worst. It took an enormous patience from God, probably never demanded of him. God is doing the impossible. That's what makes him God. And as Peter, I'll conclude with this text in 3:15, consider the patience of our Lord as salvation.
Thank you, Brother Paul. The patience of God, or what's holding up the operation of the kingdom. It's a good thing God has patience, because we don't have as much as we should have. And that in different operations. Some things we have much patience on, some things we don't. But God has his patience in everything. He has to have, especially with me. And I'm thankful that he does have patience with me. And I'm thankful to all the brethren that served us today. Brother Rob Gray, Brother Bill Patius, Brother Irwin Kalinske, and Brother Paul Malley. And you also, friends. You came and you participated. And on behalf of the Waterbury Ecclesia, we thank you all for your wonderful cooperation. And it was a new experience for us to be at this place today, and we thank you all for your patience and indulgence and help in overcoming the obstacles of meeting at a new convention site. We're going to close the convention with hymn number 87, but before we close, there'll be sandwiches on the back table for the brethren to take with them on their journeys to their home. So the Lord bless you and keep you in your journeys home until we meet again. And then we're going to close with hymn with 87 and then one verse of hymn number 64. Hymn number 87. Last verse.